Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Environmental Studies channel of the New Books Network's podcast. I'm Padmapriya Vidya Govindarajan, and I'm thrilled to host Dr. Rafiko Ruiz today to chat about his new book, Slow Disturbance, Infrastructural Mediation on the Settler-Colonial Resource Frontier, published in 2021 by Duke University Press. Rafiko Ruiz is the Associate Director at the Canadian Center for Architecture, and in addition to this book, he has co-edited Saturation and Elemental Politics. His research examines the relationships between architecture, infrastructure, and the environment across the circumpolar world. Slow Disturbance documents and analyzes the different media that were critical to the operation of the Grenfell mission that resulted in the extensive construction of medical infrastructure to the coast of northern Newfoundland and Labrador. The text pays close attention to the processes and operations of this infrastructure build-out through a combination of artifacts produced by the mission and interviews with people who had relationships with the mission. In doing so, the book studies the North Atlantic settler colonialism as a mediating project through the infrastructure it relies on and the experience of the emergent resource frontier. To this end, each chapter of the book looks at how an infrastructural zone came to be a part of the mission's reform process. I'm delighted to have you here with us. Thank you so much.
Thanks for the invitation, Padma. I'm really looking forward to the conversation.
So I like to begin by asking authors how they imagine their audience to be, especially since environmental studies is an interdisciplinary project to begin with, just like your text. Maybe you could start by tracing the significance of what you call the minor history of the Grenfell mission. So who did you intend for this story to speak to? And what does it mean for you to locate your intervention within environmental media studies? Like, what are your stakes within that?
Well, as you know, I guess as someone immersed in a PhD project, and this was where this book originated for myself as well, it's sometimes hard to project that far into the future. And you hope to have a kind of readership and a public for your work. And in my case, that certainly came, in a way, it came a bit later. And as you'll discover yourself in a couple of years, when you do the work of transforming dissertation into a monograph, it accelerates, I would say, a kind of process of public accountability. And for myself, this really started to revolve around a broader efforts at documenting, critiquing, capturing, in a way, settler infrastructural interventions and experiences within the larger project of settler colonialism, in my case, in what's now Canada, and trying to think about how embedded within that there could be a kind of method available to media studies scholars, scholars in post-colonial studies and Indigenous studies, a kind of way of apprehending how settler experiences and infrastructures have come into being sort of in tandem, come into being alongside one another and through one another. And so for me, that was really, you know, I started out working on this actually like super odd research project on an evangelical Protestant medical mission from the late 19th century, on the margins, operating what was then the sort of margins of the British Empire. And it was an effort to really try to document what, as you said, Stoller calls a kind of minor history, but that holds in itself a story around infrastructural mediation. So the lives and affects that through the settler colonial project, infrastructure, the building of infrastructure can make apparent. So for me, in terms of the broader public, who I was hoping to be invited in through this book, it was really, without maybe with like necessarily a public in mind, it was more thinking about a kind of experience of settler accountability maybe particularly, again, within my own settler context of Canada, and trying to think about how, by telling what I describe as these kind of infrastructural stories through the book, settlers could come to an understanding of how they benefit from very long and often concealed practices, processes, and really like landscapes of dispossession, everyday landscapes. And so it was really trying to come, what I've come to actually like sort of more think about in retrospect after writing the book and engaging with it in other forums, is really thinking about it as participating in a broader sort of societal shift towards settler accountability as a kind of experience that needs to be maybe more centered and valued and given importance by settlers on who benefit from and live on Indigenous lands in different contexts. So yeah, that was a bit what I've come to see, I guess, as a sort of broad public for this book. But I hope in terms of the second part of your question around environmental media studies in particular, and it's really exciting to see so much compelling work emerging out of this. It's really kind of nascent subfield in a lot of ways. And your own positioning your own work within that subfield. It really, my hope was really to think about a kind of relational model for media studies and how mediation is such a lively process, and attending to how we can track different phenomena across these processes of mediation, you know, extending to non-human life worlds is really I think what's maybe at the core of the most exciting work in environmental media studies today. So in your case, the monsoon, and really trying to understand how thinking, you know, of course, very broadly around definitions of media, practices of communication, and then what sort of through those different relational dynamics makes for a much wider circle of, as I said earlier, accountability, notions of reciprocity, solidarity, and how these can all really, in a sense, become part of the discursive, analytical, and in a way sort of research domain of environmental media studies. So I think that was a bit, that was a bit the ambition of situating this book within that subfield, but also a sort of larger research formation, I guess you could say.
Okay, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And as you're indicating, it's a very reflective process, writing this book and also engaging with this process of accountability and settler accountability. And I'm glad you brought up mediation, because that was going to be my next question. So you say in your book that you offer a situated history of infrastructural mediation. So for our listeners, what would you say about what mediation means to you here? You talk about infrastructural mediation, you talk about living mediation. Specifically, how do you analyze mediation in relation to environmental extraction while also thinking of the properties of conventional media technologies?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, of course, there's, you know, when you look up mediation in the OED, you know, there's this sort of first layer non-media studies definition, which is, of course, you know, more grounded in a kind of process of negotiation, sort of mediation between two parties, which isn't, of course, the sense that, you know, you and I understand when we're thinking about how a resource frontier comes into being through, you know, what I call infrastructural mediation. So for me, and I, it's a orientation and understanding of mediation that I share with scholars like Sarah Kember and Joanna Zielinska, who are really, really influential for my approach into building this notion of infrastructural mediation, especially through their notion of living mediation, in their sense of the term, they really see it as like becoming with the world. So it's in very broad terms, like how through being in the world and through different technologies, we become with the world through mediation. For me, where I center it more so through this concept of infrastructural mediation is to understand how in this particular, and this is why it's situated, in this particular settler colonial project, in what was then the British colony of Newfoundland, the building of infrastructure itself participated in the reform of settler fisher folk lives. So this was largely British settlers, French as well to some extent, who established themselves on the island of Newfoundland dating back to the 15th century. And so by, you know, the late 19th century, which is when my story starts, and Wilfrid Grenfell, this British medical doctor and evangelical Protestant missionary who was sent by the Royal National Mission to deep sea fishermen to Newfoundland to quote unquote minister to this population that was referred to as the toilers of the deep and sort of heroicized in many ways as providing fish to the empire. So in a lot of ways, the work that the Grenfell mission, the mission he would eventually found, would do was really around trying to account for the very lives themselves of settler fisher folks and how they could be perpetuated. So building infrastructure and participating and designing this process of infrastructural mediation was thinking about how you could attend to and support fisher folk lives and experiences by building hospitals, airstrips, nursing stations, schools, light industries, all these sorts of infrastructures that could support the larger settler colonial project. And in many ways, and in probably in environmental media studies in particular, you know, the expansion of the media concept, largely through John Durham Peters, very prominent media studies scholar, now based at Yale. It was really an attempt to account for ways of thinking about the resource frontier itself as a kind of medium where you could make out these dynamics by tracing these histories of settler dispossession through the sort of traces left on the land itself. So these are the architectures, infrastructures that settlers built and that, really in a way really permeate and constitute our present moment. So infrastructural mediation, the concept of mediation itself is a way of navigating where we are in a way in the present and how settler accountability needs to actually read through into the past through these settler infrastructures in order to make out where they come from, why, who built them, who benefits from them, etc. And trying, and actually it's the process of mediation itself that lets us see that. It's a sort of way of navigating those dynamics.
Yeah, thank you so much. So then can we talk a little bit more about what you're characterizing as the emergent research frontier and what that means methodologically for other scholars who wish to engage in similar processes? So my question on method is sort of, how are you holding together and doing so much in this context? On the one hand, you're tracing the operation of infrastructural arrangements. You're engaging with different temporal registers in this process. And your larger goal is to study settler colonialism, which, as you say, drawing on Wolf, is a structure and not an event. So what does it mean methodologically to hold all these things together and study an emergent research frontier? What is your intervention there?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, Padma. And it's something, you know, I've struggled with in building the book. Because in a lot of ways, like, and I'm curious maybe to hear your thoughts on it, you know, I really wanted the medium of the book itself to kind of register as part of the method. So it's not, it doesn't have like an entirely unconventional structure, I would say, the book, but in a sense, especially some of these sort of, I guess you could think of them in the as a kind of genre of reportage, these The Way It Was sections that really give over certain sections of the book to kind of firsthand accounts by current residents of some of the small towns where the Grenfell Mission operated, St. Anthony, which was the headquarters primarily, which is in what's now present day northern Newfoundland, the province of Newfoundland and Labrador in Canada. And these sections, The Way It Was sections, are a form of reportage in the sense that there are interviews that I conducted with residents now largely like in their 70s and 80s who experienced firsthand the Grenfell Mission. So the Grenfell Mission operated into the 1980s in these communities and is still like very much present, obviously through things like there's the Grenfell Museum in an interpretation center in St. Anthony. There are important sort of tourist sites that are part of the local tourist economy. But it was actually more in this, on the sort of more affective side of the register that I was interested in understanding how these legacies of sort of like self-help, of a kind of community-based cooperative financial system that the mission implemented, and this was dating back to sort of the early 20th century, how these were still present in the community in different ways. And so one way of doing that was to understand how settler infrastructure building, in a way, what it ultimately in some ways gives rise to and creates in this very long term, thinking about over a century, is the sort of experiences of a kind of settler affect located in place and in homes, and in what is ultimately like a very long and drawn out process of dispossession of indigenous peoples who inhabited these lands originally. And so that's a sort of roundabout way of getting to your question around the book itself as establishing a kind of experience of what settler infrastructure is and what it does. So of course it walks you, each chapter is dedicated to kind of different infrastructural project, whether it be the hospital cooperative system, this experimental aerial surveying technique called oblique aerial photography, or the production of documentary films and fiction films that the mission participated in. And in some ways, I had the ambition of the book itself trying to bring readers along through these four different experiences of infrastructure, but then also coming up against and opening for interpretation the voices of present-day settlers, even if they might not necessarily self-describe in that way, in these communities, and trying to understand how you can, you can experience infrastructural mediation in the present through the voices of these community members. So if I'm going back to like these earlier conversation we had around notion of settler accountability, it's trying to open that pathway up maybe for people, settlers in particular, who need to learn more about why they are where they are, what they benefit from, and who in a sense has paid the price for not being on those lands necessarily.
Yeah, I completely see what you're saying, though, about the book being a part of your process, because I felt like as you were analyzing and offering these like descriptions in the chapters, you were offering these images, these maps that one could trace along with you and along with your analysis, and that became a part of the reader's own process as well. And I'm sure you've been asked this before, so hopefully I'm not putting you too much on the spot, but how did you make the decisions about what to retain and what to offer the reader as part of this journey? And what were the conversations that you decided to prioritize? And are there conversations that you wish you'd had the space to have within this book?
I mean, I think I have relentless Teams notifications, but hopefully they aren't too loud for us. That was just one that popped up. It's closed, but somehow it still returns. So one register that I worked hard on myself, like, again, this really began during my PhD work, and, you know, I'll describe it as field work, even if I really didn't, you know, I don't necessarily think of it as such or think of it as a different kind of field work, but, it really began with like the photographic project that accompanied this larger initiative. I mean, it was a way for me of in a sense like creating and this I was really inspired by the work of Peter Van Wyk, who's a media studies scholar at Concordia University here in Montreal. And what he called in this book, The Highway of the Atom, sort of territorial archive. So if you go out on the land and think about it as the product of long-term processes initiated by settler colonialism, what do you see and how do you capture it in a sense? And so a lot of the photographs that I took are really in a way... capturing these kind of like settler monuments to this process. And and it's very intentional, even a lot of the archival material, and like any missionary enterprise, you know, the Grenfell Mission had a huge archival footprint. The archival material that's reproduced in the book is similarly reproduced from the perspective of sort of like my singular eye embodied in a singular moment in the archive. So it isn't meant to be a kind of perfect reproduction at super high resolution, but rather it's meant to be a kind of imperfect record of where these like trails, these infrastructural stories lead in the present. So they're kind of like, they're kind of, in a sense, artifacts themselves of trying to investigate where settler infrastructure building leads. And so in a lot of ways, I obviously wish I could have included more photographs. Also, color photographs would have been nice in some ways. And also, if I'm going even further down that road, I mean, I had... the ambition of a kind of different graphic quality, like just from a design perspective for the book itself. Now I would say in its present form, working with amazing graphic designers at Duke, but obviously with like many limitations that one might not have, I don't know, in more like an art book context or something else. I would say the kind of like compressed version of the book. And I would have liked to, in a sense, give almost like equal weight or more weight to the photographs and to these archival artifacts by letting them, in a sense, like have a more communicative relationship one to the other across the actual pages of the book in some ways. And again, like I talked about the book itself as a kind of experience of infrastructural mediation. And I think that would have been, that would have been foregrounded if it had been like a different format, a larger book, a way of having like images speak to one another in a different arrangement. But then in terms of the conversations that I didn't have that could have been included in this book, I think, like to give you an example, I mean, I spent some time in Northwest River. So this is a small community outside of Happy Valley, Goose Bay, which is the largest town, small city in Labrador. And across from Northwest River, which was after St. Anthony, which is on the island of Newfoundland proper, Northwest River was a sort of base of operations for the Grenfell Mission in Labrador. And even today, there are many, many buildings that that show these traces of the Grenfell Mission's influence, and yeah, of the way that they created these communities and affected local life in a sense. But across the river, it separates Northwest River from Sheshashi. So Sheshashi is one of the largest Innu communities in Labrador. And conversations I wish I'd had, it was partly around time, but mainly around not feeling necessarily authorized or positioned to go into a community like Sheshashi and ask community leaders or others about their experiences or their parents or grandparents' experiences of the Grenfell Mission. And in a way, it was, you know, that applies for many different contexts throughout the book, but it was a way of, I felt it as a kind of inherent limitation to thinking about tracing settler affects through this process of infrastructural mediation. And so in a sense, sort of limiting myself to understanding the kind of settler life world, not at the expense of Indigenous life worlds and Indigenous voices, and in this case, Innu experiences of the mission, but as a way of creating, again, this maybe goes to the experience of the book as a kind of, a kind of register of that process of infrastructural mediation and what it leads to, but a way of, containing that life world, the settler life world, and having it be almost claustrophobic in a sense. And of course, it would have been a very different project had I included, the voices of Inuit, Innu, or Mi'kmaq, or other Indigenous community members in the book. So that's something I've been thinking about more and more now, having it, you know, as a sort of contained narrative now, as a book does, you know, as it's fixed and is a kind of record of its own. So yeah, that's something that I've thought more and more about lately.
Yeah, I feel like that's what happens when you, you know, release a book into the world. It feels like a final product, but it's so much more than what it can be. And I think, like you're saying, it's an important choice you made, that this is the story and this is the narrative you want to stay with. And it feels like it is honest to what you were saying about settler accountability and producing settler accountability there, and have that be center stage. So I appreciate that, and I feel it. I think also it would have been a very cool project if you had been able to include like color photographs and had it be more interactive and stuff. Maybe a future project. I don't know if that's possible. I can't imagine what the size or the quality of that book would be, but it sounds exciting for sure. Maybe then, since we've spoken a lot about the human in your interface, but also drawing on your refrain of the fish came first, I wonder if you could speak a little bit more on the significance of the non-human in your analysis. And I hate to say human, non-human interactions as if there has to be a binary and that's how we understand it. But what does it mean to study the non-human? And specifically your use of slowness here, drawing on Anna Singh's conceptualization of slowness there as well, on slow disturbance, but also when you bring this conversation in parts of the book, this conversation with Rob Nixon's idea of slowness and slow violence. So how is it that you understand the non-human through this metaphor of slowness within your text?
One way that I've thought about the role of fish in this larger story is through the kind of shifting of temporal horizons that non-human phenomena open for us, I think, us as humans, who are like very narrative creatures, right? And so I, of course, opened the book thinking about fish as themselves, you know, leaving a kind of archaeological record. If through settler colonialism's effects, an indigenous group like the Beatuk, who were in many ways like the original caretakers of the island of what's now Newfoundland, and they were rendered extinct through the arrival of European settlers, you can think about the archaeological record and a sort of extension of ancestral remains through that in a sense make non-human and human worlds cohabitate in different ways. You know, we're all, as species, will eventually, you know, return to the earth in some ways and leave different kinds of records that communicate, that can serve as media for future generations. So it's sort of reading our environments in that way, as you suggested, makes this boundary, this binary human non-human, start to be a bit blurrier and starts to maybe show the productiveness of centering a process like mediation in thinking about how particular environments come into being and how extraction is a process that accelerates and renders often very violent phenomena across these different environments. So the fish in this story are really meant to, of course, precede all human intervention in this world. You know, the colony of Newfoundland at its very earliest was really treated as a kind of giant stage or fishing vessel. Stage was really like a sort of man-made structure, often made out of wood, that settler fisher folk would use to cure and dry fish, primarily cod, in this part of the British Empire. And they were built as kind of like temporary structures that could be dismantled quickly, that could be made quickly and inexpensively. So obviously not with like really durable or permanent materials. And so the island itself, by British law, for several centuries, was really treated as a kind of fishing ground. So even the land, settlers were in theory forbidden from building permanent structures on it. And so, in a sense, the very reason they were there was merely to extract fish. So it was really like a kind of, like today, you know, you have these super long distance fishing trawlers that go through different oceans around the world. And it's in a sense like that sort of arc of extraction that in this case was part of the larger British imperial project. And so in the book, the fish are meant to be this kind of like originary impetus to move towards building the extractive frontier, the resource frontier. And it's really significant and specific to the experiences of settlement on the island of what's now Newfoundland, where in 1992, it's a bit not definitively proven in scientific record, but almost certainly, due to overfishing, the government declared a cod moratorium. So this was like basically like a stop to all commercial fishing of cod, specifically on the Grand Banks of Newfoundland. And so really like it's described as a sort of collapse of the cod fishery. And so in some ways, this particular fish species is made out in the book as both the kind of like ambient condition, if you want to call it that, that brought settlers to the island of Newfoundland. And then through this process of slow disturbance, which is part of the larger process of becoming settled, you know, becoming of building up and rendering long-term the extractive frontier. So as a result, what becomes disturbed is, of course, not only obviously like the original dispossession of indigenous peoples, but also the very environments themselves sort of suffer from what I call in the book this promise of extraction that is always sort of open-ended, always there to be fulfilled. And so, yeah, the promise of extraction then creates and unfolds over time, yeah, to get more to your question around the temporality of this process, into a sort of condition of disturbance. And if for me and in the book, non-human phenomena just so clearly operate at a distinct temporal scale. And I think the disturbance, and now with global warming, it becomes, you know, I think part of the problem is this kind of like event-based nature of, you know, accelerated weather events, let's say. And yet, I think like a process like industrial scale extraction needs to be read through the very sometimes what can take centuries, but will ultimately, because this, you know, this we could say, you know, the cod fishery at this in an imperial sense dates back to, you know, the 15th century, so over, you know, six centuries, where ultimately, you know, this disturbance leads, is then a sort of story of collapse. And so slow disturbance is trying to track how, settler colonial project can figure out in a way how it contributes to that story of collapse.
Yeah. Okay. That makes a lot of sense. I wonder, though, when you're talking about infrastructural mediation of this settler colonial frontier, you're also talking about the mission's role. When you talk about the mission's role in shaping financial systems, right? You're not just talking about infrastructure there. You're talking about cooperation and care as outcomes of these infrastructural practices, but they are being channeled in service of settler colonialism. So there's an almost like ideological component there to these infrastructural worlds. So maybe you could speak a little bit to that as well.
Definitely, yeah. Thanks for bringing that up. I think, there is, and that's out of the, I guess, the four treatments of settler infrastructure in the book, that is certainly, you could say, the sort of most immaterial, maybe. And it's ultimately, you know, the introduction of a system of cooperative finance was in some ways like a way to ensure the longevity of settlement. You know, it came about through a kind of like crisis of what was called the truck system. So this is like a non-cash based economy where settler fisher folk would trade their, like a kind of barter system, trade their, often it was cod, their dried cod to the local merchant, and in return receive goods of various kinds to basically allow them to continue fishing for another season. And this cycle would continue, and often it was more of a debt-based cycle because their catch wouldn't quite cover the inflated costs of goods. And so ultimately it becomes a kind of form of indentured servitude, because there's no there's no possibility of finding another buyer for your goods, and so you become reliant on the single merchant, who is then representative of a larger merchant interest in that context. And so at the base of it, and as another dimension of the book that I talk about was really when thinking about, in this case, evangelical Protestant medical mission and their definition of good works and what, religion itself could do in the world in a material sense was, of course, to build hospitals, to build nursing stations, and to actually care very directly for fisherfolk bodies, bodies that were in this moment in particular, after several sort of failed seasons of the fishery, were in pretty dire conditions. And so even though the cooperative system was established as a way of gaining independence relatively for the fishermen to have direct to market access, and was really and also inspired by the cooperative movement in Manchester. This was a little bit later in the 1920s and 1930s, in comparison to when the cooperative system was introduced in Newfoundland, around 1905, or Southern Labrador, particularly in Red Bay. It was really what I also try to not lose sight of, even. And you're totally right. This was a kind of immaterial form of infrastructural mediation, was creating a system within which they could, the fisherfolk could sell fish direct to market, let's say. Even more so than the boats that they relied on. They ultimately had a dedicated boat that would bring their catch. Was in a way this condition of the of settler fisherfolk bodies themselves. So in some ways, this maybe something I maybe even don't highlight strongly enough in the chapter, was really the disconnect of, I don't know what the right word is, but the experience for officials from the Royal National Mission Deep Sea Fishermen, but also just British government officials going through the colony and witnessing the poverty and the hardships and the bodies themselves of white fisher folks, and the importance that they're white, and important that they were British and colonists, and thinking about them as a very racialized group that belongs and that is deserving of care. And so, I think it's a really, really nice point that bodies, ships, cash ledgers are all part of a kind of infrastructural system. But then it's the kind of, I think, and this is where I find the work of Lauren Berlant so compelling, but I think she describes it as kind of patterning of social form. And so how that is ultimately accomplished, this, and again, maybe thinking about Sarah Kember and Joanna Zielinska's notion of living mediation, is, and this is even applies, I think, in a historical register, is thinking about these kinds of everyday dynamics that were created by these systems and the ways they lived through them, and settlers could navigate them. And that is, that is directly implicating something like this sort of truck system that then got transformed by and into the cooperative system that the Grenfell Mission introduced. So this is a kind of liveliness that attending to these different processes lets you see.
Yeah, absolutely. That might be the last of my questions on the book itself. So just to round out this episode, maybe you could tell us a little bit, in the year since this book's been published, what projects have you been working on, and what are your upcoming projects?
Definitely. So, of course, alongside it, this book was published in May, and then I believe in October, the Saturation Elemental Politics collection came out, also with Duke. That was co-edited with Melody Ju, who's a media studies scholar at UC Santa Barbara, who also has an amazing book. People who are listening to this want to check it out, called Wild Blue Media. And so, of course, all of... And speaking of temporality, these two projects are, of course, anchored a few years back in the past, as they take a little while to come into the world. But Saturation is a really amazing collaborative project to think through with Melody, and to really, in some of the ways, thinking about quite maybe in a more theoretical vein, like thinking about, the relational constitution of settler infrastructure, thinking about how phenomena open up different temporal horizons and blur this distinction between human and non-human binaries. Saturation, we describe it as a kind of material heuristic and a way of tracking phenomena that, how do we put it, I'm trying to remember, essentially that sort of like coexist in a similar environment, and we track through notion of phase change, of threshold and precipitate, and really trying to see how phenomena, often through the effects of global warming, but not only, need to be attended to across these different states through which they transition. So it's really, trying to be attentive to a kind of unfolding in time and space, sometimes accelerating, sometimes slowing down, when you're trying to think about a kind of saturated situation. And they're really exciting chapters in the book that touch on everything from like the oil barrel as a kind of unit of measurement that, in Jean-Claude and Christo's work, kind of commentary on the condition of saturation oil in the, or scarcity oil in the 1970s, and then going all the way through to a really excellent chapter on the concept of enclosure and thinking about the ocean as a kind of saturated commodity space. This is Max Ritz's chapter in the book. And so, saturation merged alongside slow disturbance, but something I've been working on for a long time, dating back to sort of PhD years, really like going maybe back to like 2010, is a book now called Phase State Earth, Ice at the Ends of Climate Change. And this is going to be a book on, if Slow Disturbance is a book about settler infrastructure stories, Phase State Earth is a book about ice stories. And so what these are is thinking about, again, maybe through sort of narratives of disturbance, but in this case, what I call phase state Earth. So this is thinking about now under the conditions of global warming, and specifically through the phase state of ice, so like water in its solid form, how we've entered an era where the sort of predictability of the cycle of going through, in this case, the hydrological cycle, moving through conditions of atmospheric gases, liquid water, or sort of solid state ice, that has now been disrupted in a way. And so what the book tries to do is really think about, and that's the sort of subtitle of the book, Ice at the Ends of Climate Change. And ends in this case are both, they're really like three things. Firstly, it's the sort of geographical poles, of course, and the book attends to and tries to create a kind of what I call a kind of drift path theory. So following environmental phenomena, in this case ice, through its dissolution, and what are the, what does it let us see when it comes to, of course, acceleration of carbon effects, the ethical responsibilities of what I call the carbon subject, which is largely, you know, Western, urban, and the sort of benefits of carbon, the carbon economy. And so when you follow this drift path, you know, where does it lead? Who does it implicate? So it really begins, the book opens at 66 degrees north latitudes and then travels in terms of its structure by degree, moving to 66 degrees south. And the second sense of ends is also a kind of means ends relationship. So like ICE at the ends of climate change thinks about ICE as a kind of subject that has become, subject to the conditions of global warming. And so giving ICE a kind of agency when it comes to experiencing warming. And again, this in this book will more so foreground the experiences of largely Inuit in some of the places I've been, Inuit community members who are experiencing accelerated and amplified climate effects through global warming and what this means for their experiences of ICE in their communities. And sometimes this can be very ambiguous. For example, like in Ilulissat, in Kalaallit Nunaat, in Greenland, where there's a really important glacier, one of the fastest calving glaciers in the world, but it's also become a kind of magnet for a kind of dark tourism coming to experience global warming at its most iconic, in a sense. So icebergs calve off the face of this glacier. And of course, it's really important to the local economy that people come there and want to experience and have this proximity to the glacier. That's called Sermek Kujalek. And in that sense, there's a real ambiguity to the kind of economies that get built up out of ice, accelerated ice loss. And so it sort of spends time in that ambiguity and understands what the ends, you know, what are the, in terms of a means-ends relationship, who benefits, who doesn't, and how ice is implicated there. And then the last sense of ends is, in the book, I build up concept of end media. And so these are like experiences, not like of the end times, but a kind of trying to put forward ICE as opening these stories of where carbon effects are most manifest. Because of course, because of the albedo effect at the poles, global warming's effects are amplified, and they're in a way they kind of are making those locations into a kind of future space of what anticipating for people who live at more southerly latitudes will come, in a sense. Similarly to like vertical spaces like high mountain glaciers, etc. But in this case, it's even more pronounced. And so, and media are ways of building stories. And this is very similar to slow disturbance through different, my own photographic practice, through archival media, through a range of, different, some, there's more art actually in this book. And so thinking about how end media are stories we can tell that open up for different forms of accountability around the effects of global warming and how the carbon subject is really centered by and needs to, I'm certainly now, it's just the book is done more or less, the manuscript is out through Duke, and I'm really hopeful it'll be out in a couple of years. But it's something I'm struggling with now is like the, as with any book, is a bit of like the, like to, and what I try, I hope at least for slow disturbance, is the sort of so what question, the what are the stakes and what do you do with this? And I think to me, and maybe it's something I need to, in a sense, like clarify further, but ultimately it's a kind of, it's a way of telling the story of global warming that, that and maybe I'm being a bit cynical, doesn't lead towards like a true sense of urgency around needing to act, but rather it just tells the story, and it's a kind of documentary enterprise that makes it available for, I hope, and this is where this question of readership and publics gets opened up, but I hope it becomes a kind of story that lets, Inuit community members in Nunavut in Canada see, there are ways of telling this story that recognize how Southern settler harm has been enacted. And it's it's a kind of documentary enterprise that makes effects that aren't normally understood or pointed out, makes them manifest as what I call these end media, and can really obviously make themselves available to reconstitute and tell another story. But I think that's the ambition for the book. So we'll see. but it's really, yes. And I totally encourage you, Padma, to sort of take up it really started as a kind of side project for me during my dissertation fieldwork. And it's a way of giving yourself a kind of outlet to think alongside other concerns that are emerging through your primary project, but then have these concerns grow with you and evolve over time.
Yeah, that sounds like a super fascinating project, though. I'm really excited for it, and I'm excited to read it. And in the meanwhile, for those listening, I hope you pick up your copy of Slow Disturbance and engage more deeply with the book. Thank you so much, Rafiko.
Thanks, Padma. Thanks for initiating this conversation.